I'd run out into the world and tell every boy and girl to love before love takes itself away, just like I'm loving you this Father's Day. I made a quick recording of the song, and I was so tired and so emotional that I started crying in the last chorus. I didn't want to let everyone hear me blubbering on tape, so I reached over to erase it and sing it again. But at the last second, I decided to leave it as it was, tears and all. Around 10 o'clock that morning, I came upstairs with the cassette. By then, the brunch was in full swing. The lox and the smoked whitefish had been taken out of the refrigerator and arranged on separate platters. The scrambled eggs and onions were warming on the stove. The cinnamon rolls and the pitchers of Minute Maid were on the table, and the brunch goers were trying their best to slap on their happiest faces. When I popped the cassette into the stereo, I swear it took no more than 10 seconds for everyone to break down in tears and exit the room. It was just my dad and me now, both of us staring out the big picture window of our den, listening as the song played. As it ended, we held each other and cried. Whatever facade of normalcy we'd been putting up over the last several months washed away in the emotion of that song. I wanted to say so many things to him, and for so long. Somehow the song expressed everything so well. From that morning on, my dad carried the cassette around with him in his breast pocket. He died a few months later on Thanksgiving night. We got a call from the hospital as we were sitting around the table. The turkey was never carved. As tragic and sad as his death was, I've never felt that I was remiss in expressing how I felt. Putting my emotions on display in that song was hard. Nonetheless, I felt close enough to my dad to keep the recording intact and play it for everyone. As Professor Fredrickson explains, in contrast to our material possessions, the joy we derive from our most loving relationships does not diminish over time. In terms of creativity, this suggests to me that those deep relationships can gird us to withstand our innate fear of failure. Knowing that we have a rock-solid support system gives us the strength to ignore our self-critical voices and to reclaim a childlike relationship with the world. That support was my dad's priceless gift to me. Note: a year after my dad died, the song I'd written for him became the title track to a record called This Father's Day. It was the song on that album, not Fireman or Torture Me, that eventually got me my first major label recording deal with Island Records in 1985. Imagine that. Now, in this next brain bottle opener, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do something very similar to what I did when I wrote that song for my dad, something that will help bring you the kind of joy that is definitely not subject to hedonic adaptation. Brain Bottle Opener 5, Smartphone Letter. Hardly a day goes by without hearing that the iPhone and all the other smartphones in the world is destroying our humanity, our ability to communicate, to bond with others, and even to think. I beg to differ. I may be a lone voice out there, but I offer this. The smartphone is the most connective and most humanizing device ever created. Like every piece of technology from the knife to the violin, the way we use it determines whether it delivers pleasure or pain. I want you to take 3 minutes to write a text or an email on your smartphone to someone you love, someone who's been a mentor, a guide, a positive force in your life. Do it right now. Tell that person everything you'd want them to know, as if his or her survival into the next day were an uncertainty, and whose isn't. Now send it. That's right. Take your index finger and hit send. Writing the smartphone letter and hitting send are real actions, of course, but they are also powerful metaphors. You took a nascent idea, your love for the person you wrote to, and brought it through the pinhole, as my filmmaker friend Jim Hirschletter likes to say. In that special moment, while you were writing, your thoughts became transmuted into reality. They became a written depiction of your feelings and took on a new, more genuine dimension. By hitting send, you drew that idea one step further into reality through the act of sharing. I recently received an email from a participant in one of my Big Muse workshops, Brad G., a successful Chicago businessman, in which he described how this particular BBO changed his life. Brad told me that he and his 88-year-old father always had a somewhat distant relationship, that he'd never once heard his father say, "I'm proud of you," or "I love you." Then he went on to tell me that he sent his father a text during one of my seminars that said simply, "Dad, I don't think I've ever told you this, but I really love you." Within minutes, he received a text message from each of his sisters. "OMG, Brad, are you going down in a plane crash? Brad, are you okay? Did you just get a terminal diagnosis?" Then came the response that Brad had been waiting all his life to hear. "Brad, I love you too, and I've always been so proud of you. I'm so sorry this has always been so difficult for me to say." The postscript to this story is that since the smartphone letter Brad sent to his dad, his whole family has been communicating on a deeper level, with more frequent calls and more exchanges of real affection. Real-world applications. In many ways, this BBO is like the Swiss Army knife of brain bottle openers. It is a powerful all-purpose technique for reducing anxiety. Let's say, for example, that you've been tasked with writing a long and complicated legal brief. The weight of the effort is looming over you. The due date is causing you tremendous anxiety, and you feel like you'd do anything to stave it off. Know that this is a perfect time for the smartphone letter. There is a fear-reducing aspect to this BBO that often makes mountains shrink immediately into molehills. Now, you may be saying, how can I write something heartfelt on command? How can doing something for the sake of an exercise, particularly one that's designed to help me with a mundane business task, ever be real or moral for that matter? The magic of this BBO is that despite what you're thinking before you commence writing to a loved one, when you actually start the smartphone letter, you will be doing it from a place of truth. You will go from an intellectual process directly to an emotional one, and the fact that you're moving from one to the other in seconds makes no difference at all. This is all about doing. Your mere thoughts about how it won't work are just that, thoughts. Once you begin to act, in this case to write, everything changes. Try it, and you'll see. Chapter 6, Kid Thinking and Karate Kicks. How thinking like a child can give us grown-up insights. D.W. Winnicott, the famed English pediatrician and psychoanalyst, wrote extensively on the subject of play. Here's one of the ways he describes it. Without hallucinating, the child puts out a sample of dream potential and lives with this sample in a chosen setting of fragments from external reality. In other words, the child engaged in play is taking material from his or her inner reality or dream world and placing it into external reality, what we might call the real world. Play then becomes the intersection of dream and reality. I call that potent, unfettered, creative mindset that happens when we're deep inside the Milky Way moment, kid thinking. It's how we think and act when we fully immerse ourselves in joyous doing. We are mingling dreams with reality when we are at play. Very young children don't think about the consequences of playing, they just play. They're not afraid of how they'll look or how they'll be perceived. That comes later. It's an interesting evolutionary quirk that even though we are hardwired to abhor failure, we rarely get important information from our successes. It's the times we've come up short of our expectations that give us what is arguably our most important life lesson. Failure won't kill us. Trusting this on a visceral level allows us to create the way we did when we were kids. For some, it might feel like a regression to revert to the way they created when they were children. This wasn't the case for world-renowned artist Pablo Picasso. He was once quoted as saying, "When I was a child, I painted like a master, and now, as a man, I strive to paint like a child." My wife and I studied karate for nearly 10 years, and even though we eventually got our black belts from the legendary sensei Hidetaka Nishiyama, I always knew I'd never gotten to a level where I could use karate to truly defend myself. This isn't uncommon. Karate is an incredibly difficult skill to use, let alone master. It's my belief that for every 300 practitioners, only one of them is actually doing karate well. That is to say, these rare people, the one out of 300, can perceive exactly when an opponent is even thinking of throwing a punch or delivering a kick. Then using that special sense they've developed over years of training, they know within milliseconds which offensive or defensive techniques to apply. One of the many reasons I was never the one out of 300 is simple. I was always afraid of getting hit. You might be thinking that karate, at least on some level, is all about hitting and getting hit. But as a professional guitarist, I was understandably overprotective of my hands. As a result, my timing was always slightly off. I was always reacting too slowly, hesitating for fear that I might break a finger or two. The few people I knew who actually were karate experts didn't share my aversion to getting hit. In fact, they'd been hit hundreds of times, and because of this, they knew that while unpleasant, it just wasn't a big deal. They knew that the small failure of getting kicked in the ribs, breaking a pinky, or taking a smack to the jaw wasn't a failure at all. It was an opportunity to sharpen a skill. Without the fear of failure impeding them, they were ultimately almost always able to strike offensively or block defensively with success. Kid thinking is wonderful, but it's a state of mind that is not always accessible. What is accessible is the ability to observe how our fears might be preventing our kid thinking from taking place. Are you afraid of getting hit? And if so, what does getting hit feel like to you? Is the pain you fear greater in theory than in fact? Now, of course, there are some things that you really should fear. Falling out of an airplane with no parachute, being chased by a hungry cheetah, or speaking in front of hundreds of people with absolutely nothing to say. But most of our fears are not really fears at all. They're harmless anxieties. We often get them mixed up. The book Synopsis of Psychiatry has been a best-selling psychology text since 1972. Authors Harold Kaplan and Benjamin Sadek write, "Anxiety is a diffuse, unpleasant, vague sense of apprehension, and fear is an emotional response to a known or definite threat. So, if you're at the zoo and you happen to fall into the frigid water of the polar bear exhibit, be very afraid. That's real fear you're experiencing. Those cute white bears can swat your head off with a flick of a paw, I'm told. But if you're having trouble sleeping at night because random unsettling thoughts keep popping up in your mind, know that you're experiencing Kaplan and Sadek's textbook description of anxiety. Anxiety can often be countered by taking specific problem-solving actions, as for falling into the polar bear exhibit. Let's just say your problem-solving skills better be really good." The following story is from a master kid thinker who managed to get down to business in spite of his anxieties. Let's see what we can learn from him. Peppercorn's Passion and the pursuit of double dreams. In 1966, when entrepreneur Scott Ehrenberg's wife was newly pregnant with their first child, he began looking around for children's furniture. Scott was working in advertising at the time, and he immediately saw that there were just two types of children's furniture out there: junky, gaudy stuff at the low end, crap you'd never want in your home if you could avoid it, and fussy, super expensive stuff at the high end. Scott saw a need for something in the middle, children's furniture that was fun, hip, and high quality, and that also didn't cost a fortune. After he considered all this, a light bulb in his kid-thinking brain flashed on. With very little money and even less experience as a retailer, Scott and a partner started what would eventually become a hugely successful children's furnishings company, the Land of Nod. In launching the business, Scott started by doing the things he wanted to do, things he really loved, such as product design and creative marketing. When we sat down to speak, he still seemed amazed that he'd essentially created a national brand from a blank sheet of paper. It had all taken place one afternoon when Scott just happened to say to his wife, "Carla, how come there isn't a Crate and Barrel for kids' rooms?" Scott was intrigued by his own question. He toyed with it a little and made it more of a proactive statement. "We want to be the Crate and Barrel of kids' rooms." I listened as Scott told me how he'd just sat for a while and pondered the idea. The more he thought, the more he became engaged by the possibilities it contained. He couldn't have known how fortuitous his next action would be, but like so many of the things we've been exploring in this book, it was a tiny step, but one that was so significant. He sat down and typed out that short statement: "We want to be the Crate and Barrel of kids' rooms," printed it on an old-school dot matrix printer, and hung it on the wall in his office. All Scott had at the time was that one idea, an idea so concise that it boiled down to one sentence. I asked him how writing it had changed things for him. "I think having that vision about where we wanted to go was key," he said. "Even though we had no idea whatsoever how to get there, we had our destination." I personally find Scott's Crate and Barrel comparison fascinating. It's such a great crystallization of his idea, and he put it in terms that anyone can understand. It's as if Scott could visualize his entire business through the lens of that one focused sentence. I'd go so far as to say that if he hadn't actually written it down, there's a good chance the idea might have just floated away. I asked Scott to tell me about his doubts. I assumed he had some big ones. As he spoke, he got more and more animated. At first, he said, "I was so worried. Could we really make this business work? Could we really make a living doing this thing?" Then it got worse. It was like, "Wow, Scott, this is a really stupid idea. Are you a total idiot? You left a job where you were making $65,000 a year. Now you're not drawing a salary. Your wife is pregnant, and you could lose your house and your life savings." His wife helped a lot during those tidal waves of negativity. "Carla was my rock," he said. She'd calm me down. She'd say, "No, it's a good idea. We've been here before. Come on, you can do this." She'd pick me up. Eventually, I would just shrug it off and we'd keep moving. Finding the right person to bolster your confidence is a central component in bringing your dream into reality. We'll discuss this more in Chapter 16. I do, however, want to point out the universality of this experience of doubt. It's not that people who are able to make their goals manifest have some superhuman strength or unlimited resources, or that their objectives are so profound. The sense that an idea may be so stupid it's going to do you in is ubiquitous and unavoidable. But what Scott did that enabled his idea to continue to expand was the opposite of isolating himself and letting his fear take control. Always a bad idea. He sought the support and guidance of someone he trusted, in this case his wife, and in doing so, he enlisted an ally who kept him from drowning in the waters of pessimism. It's very difficult to save yourself when you're slipping under the waves. Almost 2 decades later, after building the land of Nod into a thriving and innovative company, things started to change. For Scott, working at the company he had helped to create, the company that was once a source of deep engagement and personal expression, slowly became drudgery. As he moved from the creative work he was passionate about, such as product development and marketing, to managing people, he felt the playfulness leach out of the whole experience. Eventually, Scott gave notice to his board. Then, after he took nearly 3 years off to travel, enjoy his family, and consider his next move, Scott's kid thinking kicked in once again. Rather unexpectedly and somewhat reluctantly, as he put it, Scott began the journey of starting yet another company from scratch, a spice company, another thing he claimed to know nothing about, which he eventually called the Reluctant Trading Experiment. During his time at the Land of Nod, Scott had purchased many of his textiles in India through a guy named Divakar. It was Divakar who first called Scott about an amazing Tellicherry black peppercorn he discovered. Divakar's dream was for Scott to distribute it in the United States. Unfortunately for Divakar, Scott wasn't biting. Scott had no knowledge or interest in anything to do with food, but Divakar was persistent, and he sent Scott a sample. One taste later, Scott was hooked. Like most people, he'd always thought pepper was pepper, but this was different. It was so compelling, in fact, that Scott started thinking seriously about ways to create a business around it. I was most interested in how this particular idea stuck with him. How did it not just slip away into the ether? Scott told me that the whole business model and the name itself were just crazy enough and interesting enough for him to want to turn it into a brand. The name, The Reluctant Trading Experiment, he said with a sly smile, came about because I was so reluctant after all. But the more I thought about it, the more I was convinced I should start selling this unbelievably good pepper under my own brand name. I think you have to be honest with yourself. I didn't try to convince myself it was the best pepper in the world just because I tasted it once and thought it was great. I went out and found a great chef to tell me what he thought of it, and I didn't pay him to get his opinion. Then I went out and did a blind taste test that confirmed my opinion. It wasn't that Scott possessed some special knowledge. It wasn't that he had incredible self-discipline either. It was just his passion for the taste of that Tellicherry pepper that compelled him to create a name for his spice company, create a website, create a blog, begin selling to consumers, and develop the emotional strength to withstand the inevitable criticism from without and within. He did all these very specific things in the present, the here and now. This dream of his was an outgrowth of his kid thinking and his love of telling true stories. As he put it, it was just a way for him to be authentic. Brain Bottle Opener 6, From Chaos to Kid Thinking. Anthony McCaffrey, a cognitive psychology researcher at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, has done extensive research on the idea of functional fixedness and the effects it has on strengthening our ability to think more creatively. Functional fixedness is something we'll revisit in this book because it's so relevant to understanding ways to improve our problem-solving skills. It works like this. When someone sees an object, a ceramic cup, for example, he or she will typically think of it as what it is. In this case, it's something to drink from. That would be its fixed function. But what if we were tasked with quickly seeing 5 other things it could be used for? We would then be moving away from functional fixedness and toward kid thinking. I've just given myself 2 minutes to see the cup as a hat for a doll, a hoop for a mini basketball game, a cutting tool if you broke the cup into shards, a high-pitched percussion instrument if you tap it with a pen, a paperweight, a cup for a shell game, a circle tracer, a small planter. You can try it with anything you see around you. Give yourself 2 minutes and create your own list. Now, in that same vein, I want you to take a pencil and make a scribble on a piece of paper. Just let your hand go free and scribble out anything. Then, much like you might see shapes and images in a cloud formation, use the pencil to connect the dots and highlight what you see. They could be faces or animals, whatever comes to mind. Do 3 of these and give yourself no more than 2 minutes for each one. When you do these drawings quickly, without thinking too much or worrying about the art of it, they're a great brain stimulator. The trick is not to think, but to react. Too much analysis doesn't help this exercise. If you go with your first impressions and aren't afraid that you won't uncover anything hiding in the scribbles, you'll find that it's a lot of fun. Don't be afraid to turn the paper to get different angles. Anything to change your perspective is fair game. Also, you'll find that once you see the face or the shape, you'll never be able to view the randomness of the original scribble again. Real-world applications. Aside from the fact that From Chaos to Kid Thinking is a really fun BBO, it's also a powerful tool to jumpstart innovative thinking. Let's say you're on a marketing team and you need to come up with names for a new food product. Doing this BBO before or at your company's next ideation session would be a great way to give your mind access to wild new ideas, weird thoughts, and associations that seem to come from a radically unfamiliar place. Get used to the notion that many of these radically unfamiliar ideas are not going to be useful in the traditional sense. The larger point is that if you allow your mind to travel to unaccustomed places, the chances that you'll find something wonderful increase tremendously. Chapter 7, Recognizing Stuck Thinking. How rethinking creativity can free our minds. Why is it that we seem to have a societal tendency to label people as either creative or not creative? The misunderstandings that result from such judgments might, for example, lead us to assume that a performance artist with nipple rings is the natural heir to all things innovative, while the white bread actuary has little capacity for abstract thought. But in reality, creativity is more akin to something like gravity, a natural force and condition that is available to everyone, not just a select few. Remember, creativity should not be mistaken for mastery. They're two very different things. Creativity is a state of being. Mastery is excellence in a set of specific skills. Anthony McCaffrey, whom I mentioned in the preceding chapter, gives scientific credence to the idea that creativity can indeed be learned, just like reading, math, or athletic skills. In one of his better-known experiments, he looked at more than 100 important modern and 1,000 historical inventions, specifically to find out how successful inventors solve problems. What he discovered became the basis for his theory about functional fixedness, a common mental obstacle. Here's an example of what he's talking about. Imagine two people tramping through the woods. Person A finds burrs stuck to his sweater and thinks, "Crap, all these burrs are ruining my new sweater." But person B, who is less functionally fixed, thinks, two things lightly fastened together. And then he invents Velcro. Person A has a perspective that's creatively limited because he focuses only on an object's typical function. A burr is always a burr and nothing else. Person B has a way of seeing things for what they could be. By eliminating functional fixedness, or stuck thinking, as I like to call it, we can open up to our creative potential. A first step in getting past being a stuck thinker is to unlearn some commonly held notions about what constitutes creativity and who and what should be considered creative in the first place. Our blind faith in stereotypes of all kinds has the profoundly negative effect of dampening our creative capacities. It also confirms that we've remained functionally fixed. First, unlearn this. These are our creative types. Painters, poets,
dancers, musicians, filmmakers, actors, authors, sculptors, inventors, designers. Next, unlearn this. These are our non-creative types. Insurance salesmen, mortgage brokers, housekeepers, mail carriers, actuaries, accountants, managers, farmers, attorneys, mechanics. These assumptive categories are popular, but like many generalizations that gain traction, they're also ridiculous and misleading. Take Joe Fisher, for example. He's a certified financial planner working for a well-known private wealth firm in New York City. He's actually a very creative person, but because his father told him he wasn't, he spent most of his life thinking otherwise. In fact, Joe's creativity shines in his marketing strategies to attract new customers. It's apparent in the way he bonds with his longtime clients, and it manifests itself most notably in the way he interacts with his family. He's always surprising them in funny ways, like the time he hid a diamond ring he bought for his wife's birthday at the bottom of a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, or the time he brought home a baby sulcata tortoise, the world's third largest species of tortoise, when his daughter was studying Darwinism in 11th grade. On the other hand, people like me who've hung the proverbial artist shingle over their door may in practice be in a very uncreative phase of their lives, working too hard toward the goal of becoming better known rather than working innovatively on the details of a piece of music or a painting. In my own life, I found that my oft-repeated pattern is to have some sort of intense breakthrough every few months, okay, every few years, that causes me to momentarily look at music and songwriting with new eyes. I become a kid thinker again, alive to the experience of writing. Then, because it's such an exquisite sensation to work with these new ideas, I can't help but repeat myself again and again. I don't stop until I catch myself thinking, hey, wait a minute, you're not creating a damn thing, you're just popping out copies again. That I'm making music an ostensibly creative endeavor simply hides the fact that I'm often on autopilot and merely making clones of my original creative impetus. Just as a person's character isn't defined by his or her race, religion, economic status, or gender, people's creative capacities can never be determined by their job titles. Creativity can exist in every arena of human endeavor, not just the ones that sound creative. Whether something positive actually results from our behavior is an ideal yardstick for measuring what's truly creative and what's not. Of course, that yardstick is the most individual thing in the world. Only we can accurately determine what those positive results are. One hint, though. A creative endeavor almost always makes something constructive happen, fostering some kind of positive growth. When we apply ourselves wholeheartedly to the things we love, it's as if we imbue them with new life. As we invest our time, money, or other resources in something or someone, our love for that thing invariably grows. Our joy and our life's rewards don't come from entertainment and distractions. They come exclusively from our intense, passionate interaction with the things and people we love, the ideas and people we wholly give our minds and creativity to. There is no other known pathway to joy. When we say someone is passionate about something, it's typically said as the highest praise. The most skilled artists, athletes, entrepreneurs, and poets are all thought to be passionate, each willing to give his or her all. I find it interesting that the etymological root of the word passion is from the late Latin passionem, normative passio, which means suffering, misery, or woe. Look, I don't know anyone who wants suffering, misery, or woe, and unless you're a masochist, and who's judging, you probably don't want suffering either. But our culture has grown so enamored with joy's younger cousin, fun, that we've forgotten just how much hard work it often takes to create real, lasting joy. The fun conundrum and the passion paradox. We are constantly being sold the idea that we can derive joy from amusement, and so we are fed endless videos, infinite hours of recorded music, electronic games so real they begin to supplant reality, pornography that's anonymous and free at the click of a mouse, movies on demand, relentless buzzing, lights flashing, words projected, products proffered, senses overloaded, all to hypnotize us into buying more amusements that lure us into the notion that we're having fun, and worst of all, that fun is joy. Fun isn't joy. Compared to true joy, fun is thin, transient, fleeting, momentary, replaceable, and self-serving. Joy is broad, all-encompassing, deep, lasting, eternal, irreplaceable, generous, and often very costly in one sense or another. Hey, I've got no beef with fun. It's wonderful and necessary, but there's a problem when we as a society begin to think of fun and joy as synonymous. Here's the challenge. Knowing that our joy is bound up in our dedication to the people and things we truly love, and that without that dedication we can have no joy, we need to be able to endure the burden that necessarily goes along with that dedication, both as individuals and as a society. That's the nature and the cost of joy. It boils down to this. Can we stave off the smaller, momentary gain for a larger, subsequent one? We all admire people who have that kind of endurance. A great deal of what we're seeing when we're watching NBA star LeBron James, for example, is the personification of his dedication to basketball. He becomes the human exemplar of endurance. It's the same when we're listening to the cellist Yo-Yo Ma, or the late great gospel singer Mahalia Jackson, or looking at a sculpture by Michelangelo. We are moved, of course, by the grace and art we're witnessing, but we're also moved by the enormity of these people's dedication, by their ability to endure. Suffering, misery, and woe don't sound like a lot of fun, and perhaps they're terms that are too strong. But the larger point is that our utter commitment to our goals is the shortest path to joy, perhaps the only path to real joy. One more simple way to determine if you're acting creatively is to see whether possibilities for positive change have contracted or expanded. In other words, are you seeing a situation or tackling a challenge from the perspective of a kid thinker or a stuck thinker? A kid thinker, as we've learned, acts in the moment. She's not swayed by outside forces or inner turbulence. She's free of negative emotions and able to look at things differently. A stuck thinker is just the opposite. He's trapped in the status quo, and because he's often swayed by his emotions, he can barely imagine how a thing or situation can ever be different from how it appears. Being an observer requires being in the moment. Being in the moment is our state of mind when we are at our creative best. Getting yourself into that mental state can be learned, and consistently practicing what you've learned so far in this book is a good way of regaining what many of us have lost as we move from childhood to adolescence and into adulthood. You can start your practice of staying a kid thinker with fairly easy exercises, utilizing things you find around you every day. For example, when someone butts in line ahead of you at the 7-Eleven, try not to lose your cool, but be forewarned. You'll have just a second or two to choose whether you want to become upset or not. Your window of volition will be there, but it's very small. The better you get at maintaining your observer status, that is, watching yourself, before you get carried away by your emotions, the more you will be able to, one, remain in control of your decision-making faculties, two, stay in the present, and three, increase your capacity for empathic thinking. An ancient text called Ethics of the Fathers describes four distinct personality types. One, slow to anger, quick to pacify. Two, quick to anger, quick to pacify. 3. Slow to anger, slow to pacify. 4. Quick to anger, slow to pacify. Can you see yourself in any of these? The best of the bunch is 1, of course. This person hardly ever gets angry, and when he does, he's easy to cheer up. At the bottom of the list is the least desirable personality type, easily annoyed and very difficult to assuage. I'm 3. It takes a lot to make me angry. I pride myself on the fact that I only get steaming mad about once every 5 or 6 years. The bad part is that when I do get angry, I go a bit nuts. The non-refundable cheese incident. I'm slightly embarrassed to share this next story with you because it illustrates one of the aforementioned once every 5 or 6 years episodes in which I fail so miserably at not losing my cool, but here goes. One morning, I drove to my favorite market and purchased 2 bags of cheese for some homemade pizza I was planning to make. I opened the first bag, and there was a big wad of green mold at the top. The second bag didn't have any visible mold, but it smelled of decaying muskrat. No big deal, I thought to myself. The pizza could wait. And I decided to take the bags of rotten cheese back to the store in the morning. I got there early, and the guy at the register told me he couldn't do an exchange because I didn't have my receipt. My pulse rate went up slightly. Well, can you please get the manager, because I spend quite a bit at this store, and it doesn't make sense that you can't do an exchange, I said. The refrigerated foods guy came to the register and said the same thing. No receipt, no exchange. My pulse rate spiked a bit more. Guys, I said, I understand that you're obviously parroting the owner's general rule, but in this case, intelligence dictates that you abandon dogmatic principle for a broader view, namely that you'll be in better stead with the store owner, the guy who writes your checks, if you exchange the rotten cheese than you will be if you lose my hundreds, if not thousands of dollars of business over this matter. Blank looks all around. Then the owner walked in, and I launched into my explanation of the problem with renewed vigor. He looked at me and said, "Do you have a receipt?" Now there was smoke. Not a lot, but definitely some smoke starting to leak out of my ears. You've got to be kidding. All I want to do is exchange these moldy bags of cheese. I'm not trying to rip you off. I just want 2 new bags of cheese. The store owner was remarkably calm, and it pissed me off all the more. "That's our policy," he said. "How do I know where you bought this cheese and how you stored it? Maybe you left it outside for a week." "Oh my God," I shouted, "you've got to be insane. Why on earth would I be driving around town with 2 bags of moldering cheese? How could I possibly profit from a scam like this? Do you seriously think I'm the guy making millions by doing exchanges on cheese 2 bags at a time?" The more enraged I became, the calmer the store owner seemed to get. "I'm not calling you a liar," he kept saying, and of course that just made me crazier. Finally, he said, "If your wife comes in and buys as much as you say she does, then she could come find me, and if I see that her cart is full, I'll exchange 1 of the bags of cheese." I slammed the 2 bags I'd been holding on the counter. "You're a total dick," I shouted, and headed out to my car. Back home, still enraged, I called Visa to see exactly how much we actually spent at the store. It was a lot. Close to $5,000 a year. Then I began writing a letter to make this loser see just what a total moron he was and how he'd sacrificed a $5,000 customer relationship for 2 bags of rotten cheese. Fortunately, I had the presence of mind to forward the letter to my son Isaac. He told me that it was great to be able to vent, but that under no circumstances should I send the letter. "Dad, you sound like a raving lunatic," he said. "Leave it to my kid to bring me back to kid thinking." It's true. I did.
And what was worse, I really like shopping at that store. Who's the loser now? Slow to anger, slow to pacify indeed. And here's the issue. Looking back, is that condition of mine, slow to pacify, an indelible part of who I am, of how I must behave? I'd truly like to be slow to anger and quick to pacify, and maybe you would too. To do so, I'd have to become empathetic enough to see the store owner's point of view. Here's what I came up with. Though I totally disagree with his policy and his intransigent stance, I must admit that I don't know a thing about running a store. The store owner told me that he's got people trying to exchange things all day long. Maybe he was telling the truth, and maybe those exchanges cut into his profits. As I said, I don't know anything about his overhead or what he pays his employees or his profit margins. Perhaps getting insane in the middle of a store was not only bad for business, but painted me as, well, an insane person. Perhaps if I'd taken him aside and explained my situation in private, it would have been easier for him to make an exception to his exchange policy. It's possible that there were language and cultural considerations that I hadn't thought about, especially as the smoke poured out of my ears. Finally, and most important, why should this guy make an exception for me anyway? And so, continuing with my experiment, I decided to do what had previously been unthinkable. I called the store owner and apologized. I didn't cast any blame on him or on myself for that matter. I simply reiterated the list I'd made. Here's what he said. "You have no idea how happy this makes me. No one understands the kinds of pressure I'm under with people running into my store every minute to exchange things they didn't even buy here. I would have gladly exchanged your cheese, but it wouldn't have been possible to do so in public. Please," he said, "come back to my store. I'll exchange the cheese. We'll sit and have tea and some cake." Having the ability to see our lives objectively, as though from a great height, is always an advantage. Try this following brain bottle opener and see if it doesn't help open your stuck thinking. Brain Bottle Opener 7, The Walk Away. This is yet another take on reducing functional fixedness, and I think you'll have a lot of fun with it. It's a slightly strange idea, but it's had a remarkable effect on helping me and others become more of a kid thinker. Single out any random object you can see in front of you. Let's use a kitchen table for our example. First, see the table for what it is, most likely wood. Then, take a metaphoric step back, and the wood becomes a tree, then a seed, then two hands planting the seed, then the face of a young boy who's planting the seed, then the house where the boy lives, the bed he sleeps in, the moonlight streaming in from his window, and the heat of the sun that makes the moon shine. Continue uninterrupted in this fashion for about 2 minutes until the table you started out with becomes something completely unrecognizable. The fun part of this experiment is seeing how the dissimilarity between a kitchen table and moonlight, for example, two things that usually have nothing in common, melts away once you consider all the in-between steps. Real-world applications. If you were tasked with finding new ways to solve a problem, whether scientific or social, using the walk-away BBO would help train your mind to discover patterns and relationships that are not readily apparent. Scotch Tape, one of the 3M company's most famous products, came about when a young researcher named Richard Drew was exploring ways a flawed adhesive could be used. Drew eventually found that if he applied the adhesive with its less than ideal stickiness to the company's newly invented cellophane tape, it would be perfect for creating the two-tone paint jobs that were in style on cars in the 1930s. This new kind of tape would adhere to the car's surface, but it was not so sticky that it would damage the paint when it was removed. Note of interest.
The use of the term Scotch in the name was a pejorative, meaning stingy, in the 1920s and 30s. One of the body shop painters who first used the tape became frustrated with its lack of adhesive material. He was said to have shouted, "Take this tape back to those Scotch bosses of yours and tell them to put more adhesive on it." The name was soon applied to the entire line of 3M tapes. Part 2 Review. In this most recent part, you move directly into the Milky Way moment by writing a letter on your smartphone to someone you love, and you shared that love. By doing so, you created a deeper bond and a greater sense of trust. Since one of our primal fears is abandonment, this BBO creates a climate in which we feel more connected and consequently less threatened. The diminution in threat naturally leaves us open to creativity. Now, from within the Milky Way moment, you're ready to move on to all sorts of creative ways of looking at things. You used kid thinking to make order out of chaos by searching for recognizable images in the midst of random scribbles. This is one of the most powerful methods of moving instantly away from stuck thinking. Finally, by doing the walkaway BBO, you went one step further. You took recognized objects and ideas and expanded them beyond their typical meanings. This allows you to see possibilities where you thought there were none. The walkaway is another tremendous boost to your kid thinking. If you're intimidated by some pending important creative project, shining a light on your elephant ropes can be a significant help. Kid thinking can help you reduce your fears. But knowing there's a Milky Way moment out there to inspire you doesn't in itself make you more able to achieve your dreams. You need a plan, a process. In this next part, we'll focus on the actual nuts and bolts of unleashing your big muse and moving your dream out into the real world. Part 3, The Process. The secret of getting ahead is getting started. The secret of getting started is breaking your complex, overwhelming tasks into small, manageable tasks, and then starting on that first one. Mark Twain. Chapter 8, Be Present. Finding your next step. We may intend to be present and take action immediately on our goals, but we often run into distractions, temptations, and interruptions. Is there any way to avoid this? If we quickly undertake just one small part of a daunting project, we will have less interference from our negative emotions and will be able to experience the Milky Way moment. Once we're there, the distractions it called out to us as we sat obsessing over them will seem far less inviting. The Milky Way moment will then afford us the opportunity to be in something I call the hourglass. I'll bet you found yourself in the hourglass at some point. It's when you're so engaged in whatever it is you're doing that time loses its dimensions. You could be painting, you could be writing a legal brief, you could be fly fishing in Montana or playing ping pong with your niece. In the hourglass, time suddenly has no relevance. It's a wonderful sensation, but forcing it to happen and actually trying to achieve it is impossible. What is helpful in bringing on the hourglass is diving into the details and finding the joy in the sensations, the emotions, and even the challenges your creative process engenders. It's a little-known fact, but in author-artist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's earliest research on the creative process, he discovered the true meaning of the phrase starving artist while studying young painters. Most of us associate the term with destitute but zealous art students. Interestingly, it has nothing to do with their socioeconomic status at all. The term derives from the idea that these passionate painters are so wrapped up in their work, so fully present and working within the hourglass, that they never get up to eat. Csikszentmihalyi labeled this flow. It's impossible to be in the hourglass if you're a stuck thinker. Aside from some minor variations, stuck thinkers come in two basic styles, idea bunnies and blockheads. Idea bunnies are people who are overwhelmed with too many good choices. They can't decide what to devote their energies to, and instead they wind up not doing much of anything. The blockhead is a person who's so trapped by fear that she's unable to even imagine what she wants to accomplish with her time on Earth. Though idea bunnies and blockheads would seem like exact opposites, they actually represent two sides of the same coin. I often hear people say that they don't know what they want to do next in life. I don't believe them. I believe they've become stuck thinkers, and that they use not knowing as a way of staying safe from the pain of failure. Think about it. Who really doesn't know what they want? Peach ice cream or mint chip? Wild sex or a walk around the lake? Our will naturally pulls us toward the things we desire and away from the things we loathe. It's native and instinctual. For some people, though, the very notion of will is confusing. Whether it's because of an overdose of advertising, peer pressure, or just plain fear, many of us have simply lost touch with what we desire. True, the more we learn and experience, the more our dreams and expectations evolve. But no matter what stage we're at, each of us has some sense of what our next move in life should be. My contention is this. Everyone, including the blocked heads and the idea bunnies, knows instinctively what they'd love to do at any given moment. The problem isn't identifying what their desires are. It's identifying the roots of the fear that prevents them from being wholly present and taking action. Do you remember those blank spaces on the black wall from the beginning of this book? Here's your chance to fill them in. Brain Bottle Opener 8, The 2-Minute Drill. I want you to take exactly 2 minutes and make a list of things you'd like to do with your life right now. Why only 2 minutes? Because if you give yourself an hour, an afternoon, a day, or a week to create the list, you'll never do it. It won't be happening in the present. Even 5 minutes can be too long in some cases. There's a big difference between doing something now and doing something a little later. The present is easy. The present is painless. The immediate present won't let your mind wander off to the refrigerator or the television. The appearance of your dreams written in actual ink and on actual paper is the first small step toward making them real. One other great thing is that the list of dreams, the list that gets written down somewhere and hangs on the wall behind your computer or in your bathroom mirror, is tantalizing to you and your creative spirit. We're all hungry for our Milky Way moments, hungry just to know exactly what they are and where we can find them. Here are some of the results of my own 2-minute drill. Scuba diving in Bali. Playing at Carnegie Hall, watching my daughter get married, performing in China, going on a book tour, lining up dates in Europe for my Big Muse seminar, learning to fly a plane, traveling to Eastern Europe with my wife, learning Spanish, recording a jazz album, playing music at a children's hospital, doing an interview for The New Yorker, buying some land and raising goats and tortoises. It's funny how many surprising things can come out in 2 minutes. Seeing my daughter's wedding, for example. She doesn't even have a boyfriend that I'm aware of. And this is weird. Buying some land and raising goats and tortoises. Now, if I'd had more than 2 minutes to do this list, I'd have probably come up with a host of reasons why that tortoise goat farm is a stupid, childish, impossible idea. And those are the very reasons that would have prevented most of these ideas from ever coming into the world. It's not a lack of ideas or the inability to select one perfect idea from among 100 that holds us back. It's fear of failure and shame and their frightening shadow, fear of abandonment. Whether or not I choose to implement this particular dream of goat and tortoise farm isn't the point. The point is that by working in the immediacy of the present, I am able to employ some kid thinking to free up my mind to imagine things I might never have considered before. Using the 2-minute time limit forces us into the power of the present. Now it's time for you to write your list. Just write. Don't overthink. Don't even think at all. I want you to list things you've always dreamed of doing, but never had the time or the energy or the resources or the courage to actually do. They can be ridiculous things, far-fetched things, ideas that make no sense at all. After you've finished, print out your 2-minute drill list, hang it up, and look at it periodically to determine which, if any of those ideas, rings true for